Some of you are thinking, what did I just see? So it was a silly video about a very serious subject. I want to thank Greg for being willing, or the anonymous person for being willing, to shoot that as a bumper video. As an introduction, we are returning to that series that we were in back in March, Sinning Like a Christian, on the seven deadly sins. And I don't know if you remember, back in March when the world felt normal, that was about, I think, 150 months ago, we were talking about the seven deadly sins as ways that they trap people, that they encumber our joy and our freedom and our ability to love. And today I want to talk about the one that comes to most people's mind when they think about sin. But first, I am so excited about what's going to happen in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, we PV people are going to gather along with other hosting churches of Central and Rose City and Sylvan Hills. We're going to gather in War Memorial Stadium in person for a combined worship that anybody is welcome to come. Invite your friends, invite your neighbors. It's a very non-threatening space. We've all had great memories and horrible memories at War Memorial Stadium, and I think this is going to be one of the great ones. I'm really looking forward to getting to see all of y'all on August 16th. So mark your calendars for that. So today, as we talk about the vice or the capital sin of lust, I want to talk to two different groups of people. I want to talk first to the group of people who is looking ahead and you have decisions to make. Maybe you're a young adult, maybe you're single, maybe you're thinking about getting married or thinking about never getting married. And then I want to talk to a group of people that's looking back on your life and you have some regrets, some decisions that you wish you wouldn't have made. In hindsight, you wish you could have that one back. And I want to try and give a gospel word to both of those groups of people. So in this series on the seven deadly sins, when I first started studying for this series, I thought this was my major vice. I thought that this was the thing I struggled with more than anything else. When people would bring up sin over the past couple of decades, I would immediately go to this and think of my own past failures. And part of that is because Christianity does have a high bar for our sexuality. But another part of it is we live in a world where this is all we talk about. 15 years ago, before Netflix, back when there was Blockbuster and just a few network channels, the stat was something like on an average network channel, 14,000 times a year, we were bombarded with a sexual event. And the church, at least in popular culture, has a reputation of talking about this all the time. And since we're in a series on the seven deadly sins, I do want to address the Christian witness of sexuality, because Jesus has good news for the world in this regard. But did you know that for the past couple of thousand years, Christians have said, yes, this is one of the seven deadly sins, but we've also said, the Christian tradition has said, it's the least deadly of all the seven. Which I know is a little bit like saying you'd get killed with a switchblade, not a tank. It's deadly, but it's still not as deadly. And here's what they meant by that. Christians have known for a long time that this is a sin of weakness, not of malice. That is, it's a sin of weakness, not of meanness. And so Christians for 2,000 years have historically been gracious and compassionate, or at least been called to be gracious and compassionate with people who have failed in this way, people who failed to honor God with their sexuality. But I'd like to push back a little bit on the idea that Christians talk too much about this. When did we in the Western world start to get the idea that the church got this wrong on sexuality? I mean, we spend billions of dollars every year on pornography. Pornography is a bigger industry than all the major sports leagues combined. We spend billions of dollars on that. Employers lose billions of dollars a year because their employees are participating in that online at work. We spend an incredible amount of money and time on something that can never be satisfied, because the nature of lust is that it can't be satisfied, because you can never get enough of something that almost works. You can never get enough of something you really don't want. And nobody wants lust. But maybe not for the reasons you're thinking. To explain what I'm talking about today, I want to come from one of my favorite stories in the Bible when I was growing up. This is one of my favorite stories because it's got it all. It's got, you know, Die Hard and 50 Shades of Grey and a dash of Superman thrown in there. It's about a guy named Samson, and if you grew up in church, I bet you think you know this story, but you might not know it as well as you think you do. Samson's story, for those of you who are new to church, Samson's story is in the book of Judges, and Judges is the darkest book in the Bible, in my opinion. A lot of people have lost their faith reading through Judges, so let me just give you some words of warning. First, Judges is written descriptively, not prescriptively. It is not God saying, this is how people should live, or this is how the world should be. It's God describing, this is what life looks like when my people go off the rails. And in Judges, God's people repeatedly go off the rails. And God gives them what they want. It's one of the worst things God can do in the Bible is give people what they want. So they're constantly walking away from God. They find themselves oppressed by other nations. Then they realize they had left God and they pray for God to send them a judge. Now, when we're talking about judge, we're not talking about like Judge Judy. We're talking about like a deliverer, like somebody who will raise up and deliver them with, you know, a strong person out. So maybe like Judge Judy, but, you know, like somebody who would deliver them from their enemies. And in Judges 13, chapter 13, God's people are in a really low point. They're being oppressed by the Philistines. And so God raises up a judge named Samson. An angel comes to an older infertile couple and promises God is going to give you a child. And not just any child, a deliverer, a judge. You should call him Samson. And he should never drink wine. He should never be around dead things. And he should never cut his hair. He's called to be different than everyone around him. He's going to be holy and set apart because Samson is going to be God's man and do great things. At the end of chapter 13, if you were reading this story for the first time, you would be filled with hope and excitement. But that wouldn't last long because in the very next chapter, we find out that Samson has met someone. And by the standards of ancient Israel, we find out he's met the wrong kind of someone, a Philistine someone. Philistines were the very people who were oppressing the Israelites. And that very nation that has their boot on the neck of the Israelites, Samson is wanting to marry into. And the problem isn't just that she's a Philistine. There are other honorable mentions in the Hebrew Bible about Philistines. The problem is she doesn't worship the God of Israel. She hasn't bent her knee to the God of Israel. So here's what Mama and Papa Samson say in Judges chapter 14, starting in verse 1. Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. His father and mother replied, and again, this is not about ethnicity. You can see this is about her not having bent her knee to Israel's God. Isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all of our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised to get a wife? But Samson said to his father, get her from me. She's the right one for me. The actual Hebrew he uses here is he says, she is right in my eyes, which is a big phrase in Judges. It's actually repeated over and over again. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So what was evil in God's view was right in Samson's eyes. So Samson, he wants to marry this girl. He's going to, you know, the Old Testament version of date her. He's going to her hometown, and on the way to her house, a lion attacks him. And Samson, because he's so strong, just grabs the lion, and Judges says he rips it apart as easily as one might rip apart a young goat. You know, in case that's a metric you're familiar with. He rips it apart like a young goat. And then a few days later, as he's walking back home, he sees the decaying lion's carcass and some bees had made a hive in there. There was a hive of honey in a decaying lion's carcass. And Samson thinks to himself, you know what? This would be an awesome riddle. So when he goes back to see his girlfriend, they're starting to plan the wedding, and they give him 30 Philistine groomsmen. And you thought your wedding party was big. And he doesn't know these guys probably, but they're his, you know, they're in the wedding party. And he starts planning the festivals, and he says, I want to make a bet with you guys. He bets his 30 new Philistine guy friends that he's got a riddle they can't solve. And if they can solve it, he will give them each a new set of clothing. But if they can't solve it, they will give him a new set of clothing apiece. This is a day before everybody had, you know, a closet with a lot of clothes in it. So this was a huge risk. Samson is betting the house, but he's pretty confident because it's an awesome riddle. And he says, see if you can figure out what this means. Out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. What am I talking about? You got 4 days to figure it out. And for 3 days, these Philistine guys, you know, sit in a room trying to figure out what the riddle could be about. And by the way, wouldn't you love to be in that room? What's this riddle about? An elephant with a lollipop. No, that's dumb. A tiger with a cookie. No, that can't be it. And they finally, you know, hit rock bottom, and they go to Samson's fiance, and they get her to use her charm to find out the answer from Samson. They put enormous amount of pressure on her, and so she does. She gets the answer from Samson, and she sneaks it back to them. And right before the wedding happens, Samson goes to his 30 new acquaintances, and he says, all right, guys, time to pay up. Do you know the riddle? And they say to him, you know, we were thinking about it. And what could be stronger than a lion and sweeter than honey? And so Samson gets so mad. And here's what he said. Again, Judges is descriptive, not prescriptive. In verse 14 or verse 18, he says, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. If you not plowed with my heifer, I'm no love doctor, Samson, but I think you're going to have problems in the romance department. Although I do think I saw that as a Valentine's Day card growing up in Arkansas at some point. But here's the point. He calls this woman he supposedly loves a heifer. And we think, oh, that's so disappointing, Samson. But honestly, it's only surprising because that's not a word we use much these days. If you listen to our music, if you listen to the movies we listen to, we dehumanize each other. We use each other. We use words other than woman or man made in the image of God to talk about each other. And honestly, in this story, this woman is one of the saddest tragedies in the whole story. She's an unnamed woman, and she's just simply the object of verbs. Samson just sees her. Samson wants her. Samson gets his parents to go get her. Other Philistines use her to get the riddle, which means she loses Samson, and the Philistines marry her off to someone else. And Samson doesn't like that. It makes him so mad, he starts World War III. And he does it, typical Samson style. He grabs a bunch of foxes and he ties their tails together like you do. Then he lights it on fire. And then he sends it through their crops and he decimates the Philistine economy and their crops. And they don't like that. The Philistines don't like that. And so they go and they kill the woman he was going to marry and all her family. And this is one of the points Judges is making. Violence doesn't work. It's wanting you to know that right out of the gate, thousands of years ago, because nobody ever sees violence happen to them and thinks, you know what? I deserve that. That was a fair punishment. No, what we do, what we always do, is escalate it. But this isn't a sermon on violence. It's a sermon on lust, and specifically a sermon on weakness. Because for all his strength, Samson is remarkably weak, and he's remarkably consistent. Because just a few verses later, Samson meets another Philistine woman, one that even if you didn't grow up in church, chances are you've heard her name, Delilah. She became one of the most notorious women in history. And here's the scene. In Judges chapter 16, starting in verse 4, it says, Sometime later, Samson fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 100 shekels of silver." So, at least Samson loves her. That's the first thing we find out about this. It's the first emotion we hear from Samson outside of anger. The Philistines knew there was something more than muscles that was the secret of his strength. And they also figured out that Samson had a weakness. They asked Delilah to lure Samson. And every fisherman that's listening right now gets lures. You know that lures are tempting, but they've always got a hook in them. And they agree to pay Delilah to use her body as bait, to exchange her body for secrets. They're going to use her like they used the woman before her. And so one night, while they're cuddling, she asks Samson, "What's the secret? What makes you so strong?" And Samson, he tells her a straight up lie. He says, "You know what? If I was to be tied down with 7 bowstrings, I would become as weak as anyone else." And then he goes to sleep, and surprise, surprise, he wakes up and he's tied with 7 bowstrings and Philistine soldiers around him. And Delilah, acting like she cares, yelling, "Samson, wake up, the Philistines are on you." But he breaks out of the bowstrings and he beats up these guys. And for those keeping track, that's totally the screenplay to the ending of Superman 2 with General Zod. But the only problem is Delilah's not giving up. She kept going after him. She accuses him of making her look foolish in front of her, you know, the men who just happened to break in and tie him up with the very thing he told her would make him weak. And I don't know how long it took, maybe days, maybe months, but eventually she wears Samson down to tell another story, another lie. He says, "You know what? If I was just tied down with 7 new ropes, that would be my trick." So he goes to sleep, and once again, he's tied down with ropes. The Philistines are around him. Delilah wakes him up. He breaks them off and beats them up. And once again, Delilah starts to be like, "Samson, I feel like we've just got a real trust issue, me and you. I mean, why aren't you telling me the truth?" So Samson eventually gets a little bit closer to the truth. He says, "You know what? If you were to braid my hair..." So now he's getting to the actual point of his strength, his hair. "If you're just to braid my hair, I would lose my strength." So he goes to sleep again. She braids his hair. Samson wakes up with Philistines surrounding him, her yelling, and he looks like an Old Testament version of Pollyanna, I guess. And again, he still has his strength, and he beats the Philistines up. And finally, Delilah has had enough. She's the patron saint for persistence. She just keeps on. "Samson, why don't you trust me?" Until finally, this happens. In chapter 16, starting in verse 15, "Then she said to him, 'How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the third time you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength.' With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was sick to death of it. So he told her everything. 'No razor has ever been used on my head,' he said, 'because I've been a Nazirite, dedicated to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me, and I would become as weak as any other man.' When Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she sent word to the rulers of the Philistines, 'Come back once more. He has told me everything.' So the rulers of the Philistines returned with the silver in their hands. After putting him to sleep on their lap, she called for someone to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. Then she called, 'Samson, the Philistines are upon you.' And he awoke from his sleep and thought, 'I'll go out as before and shake myself free.'" And in one of the saddest lines in the whole Bible, it says, "But he did not know that the Lord had left him." I don't know about you, but this story growing up, it frustrated me so much. I mean, don't you just want to shake Samson? After the haircut, of course, but don't you want to just shake Samson? Like, don't you get it, man? She's the only one you're telling these things to, and you wake up, and it happens to happen exactly like you told only her. Don't you get it? She is not the soulmate you think she is, buddy. Don't you just want to shake him because he's so dumb? But I don't want to do that anymore. I don't think he's that dumb anymore. At least not any dumber than any of us. Because after 20 years of ministry, both in jail ministry and pastoral ministry, and also looking in the mirror, I can't tell you how many times I've seen people throw away their lives for exactly this. Sometimes I've seen them throw away their families. Sometimes I've seen them throw away their freedom, like literally like in jail. I've seen people do a lot dumber stuff in the name of lust. And basically what Samson is doing is little at a time, he is walking away from God, one step at a time. I mean, his promise, the thing he was pledged to, was not to drink alcohol, not to touch dead things, and not to shave his head. And in the first chapter, he blows through the first two, and this is his final one. Now he's lost his hair, the symbol of his dedication. And then the Philistines, they capture him, they put him in prison, and they poke out his eyes, which is where the book of Judges was telling us the problem was all along. I actually think when Jesus, in his famous Sermon on the Mount, when he says, if any one of you, it would be better for you to pluck out your eyes than for you to lust after a woman, I think he actually is referring to this story. Because think about it. The great irony of this story is that Samson never got anything like what he wanted. He never wound up with an intimate relationship, with true intimacy with the woman he was pursuing. And as some irony, he actually ends up as a woman in the story. The Philistines have him grinding grain, which back in the day, that was what only women did. They're trying to humiliate him because if you're a blind, weak prisoner, you have to do what your captors are telling you to do. So what does all this have to do with us and the seven deadly sins? There's a saint who lived hundreds of years ago who said, the opposite of love isn't hate. It's use. I think that's right. When we really love someone, we fight for them to become the person he or she is. But when we lust, we thangify them. We reduce people to what they can do for us, to a tool. I think about these stories. Samson is using these women, and these women are using him. And the reason this is so important for us to get is because we live in a world where the dominant cultural narrative, the one that Hollywood loves to tell, the one that our music that we listen to, from country to hip-hop to everything in between, loves to tell, is that the problem with life is that we are sexually repressed. That the big storyline that has been going around, and I don't know if a sermon can fix this. I don't know if just an hour of church on Sundays can fix this. Because it's so everywhere in our world. But the dominant story that we live in, that our kids are growing up living in, that our parents grew up living in, is that the problem is we're sexually repressed. And like Adam and Eve in the garden, somebody finally has their eyes opened and they experience freedom. But we always tell those stories without the fall, which is ironic because, listen, there is always the fall. And you can believe that if you want, but please don't lie to yourself because it's not a new idea. That's as old as time. Historically speaking, you know religions have celebrated all kinds of sexuality? That historically speaking, you know, the 2,000 years ago in the worship of Aphrodite, you could do what you want with whoever you wanted, whenever you wanted, basically, as long as you had the money for it. There was a whole cult of temple prostitution, and along come the Christians and say, you can't put the weight of worship on your sexuality. It can't bear it. Did you know that historically speaking, the new idea, when Moses comes down the mountain and says sex is meant for one man and a woman in between marriage covenant, that historically speaking is the progressive new idea. It's important to remember when Christianity first started to make its way into the Greco-Roman world, this was seen as good news to almost everybody, especially women. Christianity says what it says about sexuality, not to squash our joy, but to give us greater joy. Because, and this is important to see, right here in the Bible is a story thousands of years old of a man who gets everything. He's not repressed at all. He has nothing holding him back, and that's his problem. He gets everything he wants, and it costs him everything he has. And everyone and everything he loves is destroyed in its wake. It's not just that it destroys the people around you. There's plenty of people who can bear witness to the fact it does destroy the people around you, the people that you love. It also destroys you. And this isn't just Bible talking. In the Journal of Sex Research, a California State University article published a few years ago found that engaging in casual sex causes a lower sense of well-being and a greater chance of great anxiety and depression. The reasons Christians have talked about this as one of the seven deadly sins is it because it slowly takes away your capacity for freedom and joy and intimacy. In other words, and this is so important, we are not punished for our sins. We are punished by our sins. And the reason it makes us unhappy is because it's just wanting a part of a person. It separates a soul from the body. Thomas Aquinas once said, "We cannot live without joy, and when we're deprived of true spiritual joy, we settle for carnal pleasures." The reason that Christians warned against this vice, and actually every world religion has warned against this vice for the last few hundred years, is not because it's against pleasure, but because it's a poor substitute for something real. Now I want to talk to those of us who have regrets. Those of you who, you could have stood up here and preached this sermon better than me this morning. You could have told us your story, and we didn't need to hear the story of Samson because you lived it. I want to talk to those of us who are caught in this vice and maybe have used people in the name of words like freedom, but slowly have realized we're trapped in bondage. One of my favorite verses in the Old Testament happens to be in this chapter. It's verse 22. Because after they had poked out his eyes and put him in prison, it says, "But the hair on Samson's head began to grow again after it had been shaved." In prison, Samson starts talking to God again. Maybe he moved an inch or two. It might not be much of a prayer, but then again, it doesn't take much. And in prison, blind and captive, Samson turns back to the Lord. C.S. Lewis once suggested that God allows for some of us to fall in to the lesser vices like lust and sexual immorality to save us from the greater ones like self-righteous pride and greed, the ones that can truly destroy our soul. Can I tell you, I have seen people ruin their lives with lust, but I've seen this too. I've seen this. People who hit rock bottom, often in jail or prison or lost their family, and all of a sudden come to grips with how much they need God. Now, I am not trying to say Jesus does not have a high calling on our sexuality. It's just important to remember who has the calling on our sexuality, what Jesus is like. Jesus has always been compassionate and gracious to those who realize they have sinned and turned to Him. God is always calling us to greater joy. God is always trying to get rid of the vices that really keep us from freedom. And if this is you today, I can't tell you, I hope this is helpful. The Holy Spirit can help you get free of this. I have told so many college-aged men and young adults that if you struggle with this vice, one of the best things you can do is partner with the Holy Spirit by fasting from food. That is something that for 1,500 years Christians have been suggesting, because your body is like a toddler throwing a temper tantrum. And one of the things that you do when you fast from food is you're teaching your body that it's not in control, that it doesn't get everything it wants. And it actually, I've seen this personally and with other people, it gives you freedom and mastery over your body. You're coming at this vice from another angle. You don't have to be in bondage. But if you are, there is hope. Grace is never far away. You know my favorite part of this whole story of Samson? He only shows up in the New Testament one time, and it's in Hebrews 11, the Hall of Fame, where the author of Hebrews is talking about the great ones who have gone before us, you know, David and Moses and the Christians who were martyred and killed, and the world was not worthy of them, and Samson. It gives me so much joy, because if there's room for Samson in the Hall of Faith, maybe there's room for people like us, too. Can I tell you, one of my favorite parts of ministry is doing the funerals of senior saints, of men and women who have been married for decades, and one of them is burying their other spouse. It moves me to my core every time, because I watch the husband or the wife burying this person that they've loved so deeply and so well. And I know why the church has called it a sacrament. It's a means of grace. It's God showing the world a glimpse into His heart. And that's what we want. What every one of us is after is not just sexual desires fulfilled. What we're after is intimacy. We want to know and be known. We want to, with our lives, tell, whether single or married, a parable of the love of God. Do you know that Jesus uses the word lust when He's doing the Last Supper with His disciples? He says, "I have eagerly desired," or in the original language, "I have desired with a great desire to eat this meal with you again." Because that's what all of our desires are really pointing towards. To know and be known, to live in community, to not feel shame, but to be trusted and known by God. And that's what we do every week when we gather together. We are working towards becoming the kind of church that can show the world what God is like. And if that is what you're lusting after, then take heart. God loves to satisfy. Because that is love, actually.